Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for February 9th, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, we devote our entire show to sustainability and energy, the topic of a special section in this week's Science. We'll talk about some of the challenges that will confront scientists of today and tomorrow in building a sustainable energy future, and look at whether R&D spending is up to those challenges. We'll also get a European perspective on emissions trading and talk with a scientist who's working on a clean approach to creating hydrogen fuel. Stick around, there's a lot more to come. Last week, the world received a wake-up call from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. In its strongest statement yet, the panel reported that the evidence for global warming is unequivocal, that human activity is almost certainly behind the warming, and that if we don't change our behavior quickly, things are going to get much worse. In a society with a seemingly limitless appetite for energy, resolving those problems will require a global effort to move away from inherently limited fossil fuel sources toward cleaner, more sustainable energy. The scientific and policy paths toward sustainable energy is the subject of a special section in this week's Science. In one contribution to that section, George Whitesides of Harvard University and George Crabtree of the Argonne National Laboratory provide what they call a personal and idiosyncratic list of long-term problems in the science of sustainable energy technology. We're very pleased to have Dr. Whitesides on the line with us now to talk a bit about the scientific challenges on the energy front. Dr. Whitesides, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Well, Dr. Whitesides, I'm old enough to remember the words energy crisis being batted about in the late 1970s. Obviously, these are very different times, but would that be an appropriate term to use today?
There's lots of energy around in terms of fuels such as petroleum and coal, and there is a strong nuclear option. There are a number of possible ways of to go, but we are very concerned with the issue of the impact of fossil fuel combustion on global climate. And so the issue of an energy crisis is a combination of producing enough energy, and that's a problem, but very importantly, producing it in an affordable way and in a way that's compatible with maintaining the climate in a fashion that seems appropriate for our future.
Well, let's look at just the relatively near-term part of that future. One of the things that struck me in your article is a statement that most of the global-scale energy and sustainability problems we face today will still be with us 50 years from now. What does that mean?
What I mean by that statement is that if you ask what it is that's driving the problem now, it's a combination of rising demand from particularly the developing world, but also from the United States and Japan and Europe, coupled with a change in the supply. Roughly in the next 20 years, we're going to have to double the supply of energy. More properly, between now and about 2050, we'll have to double the supply of energy. The issue of how one gets there in practical terms is very unclear to everyone. In the enthusiasm for trying to move to begin to solve this problem, what one can basically do is to apply existing technology, what we have now, try to implement it. Those big technology projects are very expensive and take a very long time. Then there is the idea of starting science now or advanced research, whether it's science and engineering, that will provide new approaches to the problem in the longer term, in the period of tens of years. So that may not be for 40 or 50 years. But we need to have a balance between the short term and the long term. And the question of the strategy between the long term knowledge driven and the short term technology driven investments is a very serious issue that we need to think about.
Okay, well, on that note, let's look at some of the long term investments in science that you identify in this article as vital ones. In your article, you state, for example, that catalysis is central to everything in energy and global stewardship, but you also say it's astonishing how little we really know about this.
Yes, I'm a chemist by background, and the business of chemistry is in part catalysis. So what is catalysis? A catalyst is a material that makes some reaction run faster. It isn't itself consumed, but it makes something go better. And so catalysts are ways in which, for example, life regulates all of its processes. So if you're interested in photosynthesis, the reactions that convert carbon dioxide and sunlight into glucose and other plant materials are all catalyzed by various catalysts in the plant. The processes that go from crude oil to gasoline, or ultimately will go from coal to gasoline or to other fuels, most of those are catalyzed reactions. Everywhere that one looks, the removal of pollutants from the tailpipe of automobiles, these are all catalytic processes. And you would think that, given the fact that this is so central to energy and to chemistry broadly, that by now we would have figured out lots about catalysis. But it's one of those very fundamental problems that are extremely interesting and very basic, where the answers are still largely unknown.
Well, you mentioned photosynthesis in what you were just saying, and improving on that natural process was actually another long-term priority you cited in your article. I guess this relates particularly to the development of biofuels?
It relates to the removal of CO2 from the atmosphere by photosynthesis and conversion into other forms that might be useful for various purposes. I mean, biofuel is certainly one application. Just removing carbon dioxide is a potentially important part of the overall strategy for managing carbon in the atmosphere. So both of those are important potential applications.
Well, what are some of the other challenges in basic chemistry and physics that you see ahead?
There are a range. It's a wonderfully variegated palette. These range from what you might think of as a very simple problem, such as understanding everything that we can about carbon dioxide. If carbon dioxide is the major gas that contributes to global warming, we need to know everything that we can about it. That's a simple problem, and I put simple in quotation marks. At the other end of the spectrum, there are problems that have to do with understanding how to think about matters like the relationship between fossil fuel combustion and global climate that are extremely complicated. They involve understanding the fluxes of carbon, where they go, where the carbon ends up in oceans and plants and soil, what we can do in terms of remediation or in terms of sequestration, a whole series of things with both very strong implications for the very complex system of oceans and atmospheres, and also very important economic and geopolitical kinds of concerns. This issue of energy is something that's going to provide opportunities and tax the resources of the scientific and technical communities, science, engineering, and technology throughout the world.
Okay, we've talked about some of the technical challenges here, but there's also, I guess, the more fundamental challenge of actually mobilizing the resources. I mean, you've got to get the money and brain power together to make this happen. How do you see that playing out?
The thing to remember is that science and technology, science, engineering, and technology are not done in an abstract way. They're done by people. And the effectiveness of our solutions to these problems and the speed at which we get to them is going to depend upon the application and dedication of smart, interested people. So a big part of this is to make a case that working on problems in energy is the kind of activity that very, very smart young people should be willing to devote their life to. And the National Institutes of Health provides a kind of example for this, because NIH, over the course of the last 30 or 40 years, has put together a program which has provided stable patient support for the biomedical enterprise that has resulted in the generation of a community of biomedical scientists that really is extremely effective. So the country needs to decide, the country and the world need to decide, whether the problem of energy and climate and planetary stewardship is an important enough problem, a big enough problem, to really engage the best young people that we have globally in working on it, and if so, to think about how to make a career, a lifetime working in that area, something that's rewarding and practical and a good thing to do.
Dr. Whitesides, thanks for joining us today.
Very good. I'm happy to do so.
George Whitesides is the author, with George Crabtree, of the article Energy Problems for Current and Future Generations of Scientists, which appears in the February 9th issue of Science. Defining the scientific imperatives of sustainable energy is one thing, figuring out how to pay for them is something else. The oil crisis of the 1970s spurred substantial new spending on energy R&D. Is something similar happening today? For some thoughts on that, we turn next to Science Deputy News Editor Dan Cleary, who writes on the topic in this week's special issue. Dan, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Well, Dan, let's start with the question I just posed. In light of everything we're seeing on the climate front, are we seeing a new surge in sustainable energy R&D?
It's hard to call it a surge yet, but there have been increases in some areas, particularly ones that are carbon neutral, such as wind energy and energy conservation and efficiency. Those sort of areas have been growing steadily through this decade. But it's nothing like the amount of money that was being spent 25 years ago. You know, around 1980, worldwide, there was about $14 billion being spent on energy R&D, a lot of it in nuclear energy and, better ways of burning coal and things like that. And all of that died away very, very rapidly during the 1980s and 90s. So by the year 2000, the figure was less than $8 billion.
Well, that's quite a drop. Are there any non-governmental funding sources that are picking up the slack here? Any industry activity?
Surprisingly little. Since the 1980, the energy industry has been very much deregulated in the United States and elsewhere. Before that there was a compulsion on the energy industry to devote a certain amount of money to research, that no longer exists, and they are, not devoting a lot of money to R&D. In fact, I think the energy industry, on average, puts in about one-tenth of the average into R&D of overall of U.S. industry.
Well, in your article, though, you do mention a few specific initiatives, both governmental and industry, that are underway. I wonder if you could just talk about a few of those.
Yes, the areas such as energy conservation and energy efficiency that have been sort of slowly growing, but areas such as wind energy in Europe has been a big thing. There was a decision in a number of countries and the EU as well that this was a good area to invest in, not just to fight climate change, but also to corner this market of technology and create companies in Europe that were at the forefront of that. And as a result, there's huge amounts of wind farms being built all over Europe, and it's quite a big industry in Europe now. And in the U.S., there's a lot of emphasis now on areas such as biofuels, and both the Department of Energy and private companies are putting money into research to better ways of converting crops into biofuels.
Well, given the scope of the problem, though, strategically, these sound like just a drop in the bucket.
They are. People say that if we are going to avoid the worst impact of climate change, as they're foreseen at the moment, we need a lot more money in energy technology because we just have to cut down the carbon emissions so drastically to make any difference. People are talking about a doubling in funding needed. And, there was one report from the National Academies of Science in 2005, which was calling for the creation of a special agency called ARPA-E that would be specially devoted towards funding energy projects. They were talking about $1 billion a year going into that agency just to fund energy projects.
Well, I guess as the numbers you're citing suggest, ultimately this is a question of political will. We've certainly had a lot of news recently on the climate change front with the IPCC report, but in the U.S. at least, it seems like a lot of politics and subsequent energy investment is driven by oil prices, and the price of oil is down about 25% since last summer. How do you think that factors in?
It's hard to say. It's certainly true that the high cost of oil was one of the triggers that caused the big increase in the 1970s and early 1980s. But its decline after that wasn't only to do with dropping oil prices. There were other factors too, such as deregulation of industry and so on. So it's hard to know whether, you know, interest in energy R&D is going to stay at a high level even if the oil price goes down. But it doesn't look like climate change is going to go away in a hurry, so the interest may stay high.
Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Science Deputy News Editor Dan Clary writes about R&D funding for sustainable energy in this week's issue. Coming up in a moment, a European perspective on emissions trading. Sustainability is also the theme of the 2007 annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which takes place in San Francisco from Thursday, February 15th through Monday, February 19th. If you can't make it to this year's meeting, the next best thing is the meeting coverage you'll find at the AAAS and Science Magazine websites. The Science News staff will be on the spot and providing regular dispatches on our free Science Now daily news site. They'll also be blogging interesting tidbits and news items, particularly on the topic of sustainability, in a new news blog. We'll be podcasting from the meeting as well, and a special weblog at the AAAS website will provide regular updates on media coverage of annual meeting stories in science. To keep tabs on all the action during the meeting, come to www.sciencemag.org and follow the links to AAAS annual meeting coverage. One large-scale policy response to excessive carbon emissions and the climate change threat have been emission trading programs, in which market forces are harnessed to drive down total carbon emissions over time. For a European perspective on this approach, and on the roles of technology and policy solutions in the years ahead, we turn things over to Joanne Baker of Science International.
With me is energy economist Professor Michael Grubb of Cambridge University, who's also chief economist at the UK's Carbon Trust and a visiting fellow at Imperial College. Professor Grubb, thank you for joining our podcast today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So to become more sustainable and to help avert climate change and manage our resources and energy, we obviously need to switch our energy habits. And one policy tool for doing this is emissions trading. The European Union has been trialling an emissions trading scheme for greenhouse gases since 2005, which is the largest scheme of its kind worldwide. Can you tell us more about how it operates and how well it's working?
Yes, the European Emissions Trading Scheme is a simple idea, which was really originally developed for controlling sulfur emissions in the US. One sets a cap on the total allowed emissions from all of the facilities covered, which in this case amounts to about 10,000 of the major sources of CO2 in the European industrial sector. And rather than making those fixed limits, one allows companies to trade. If they can't hit their limits, they can go and buy allowances from companies that can cut back more and more cheaply. From an economic perspective, the idea is you create a market in the allowances to emit, and companies will go and hunt out the least cost ways of reducing emissions anywhere in the coverage sectors. So it's, in that sense, the kind of instrument that economists like that can deliver emission reductions at lowest cost. It's been operating since the beginning of 2005. And as I would expect, we've learned a fair amount about some of the good things about it, some of the things that haven't worked so well. And a lot of those lessons are now being incorporated in the next phase of the scheme, which is due to start in 2008.
So what are the things that have worked well and less well, and what kind of changes are you going to make in 2008?
Well, I think the thing that has worked well is that it really has functioned as an effective emissions trading market with clear exchange of allowances, a number of brokers appearing, clearly transparent, traceable carbon price, strong verification, strong monitoring and verification supporting regime, which has ensured that an accurate accounting of emissions and whether they tally to the allowances. So all that's on the plus side. The downside, the biggest single downside, is that when the first year of verification reports were in and examined, it was quite clear that actually companies either had been given too many allowances or had learnt to cut back more quickly and more cheaply than had been expected. So there was actually a considerable surplus of allowances. And the result was that the price of carbon under that scheme really fell quite dramatically and is now tailing out down to very low levels for the remainder of this first phase during 2007. And that arguably is a lesson that one should actually be a bit tougher in how allowances are done. And that actually is why Europe is currently locked in negotiations and disputes about the number of allowances that should be given out for the next phase.
And what do you say to people who believe that we can solve all these problems just with technology alone?
Well, it's two very different variants of saying we can solve this problem with technology. One is to say that we can be creative. Industry can develop low-carbon solutions, low-carbon technologies, and that in 50 years' time we could have societies with low emissions and still be perfectly well off. I agree thoroughly. I think the other version is to say that we need technology to solve this problem instead of policy. And personally, I find that nonsensical. I mean, again, let's take the most popular example, which is carbon sequestration technologies. If there's one thing we know about a power plant with carbon capture and pipeline and storage, is it's going to cost more than the similar power plant without all of those things. So nobody is going to invest in it unless there is a strong policy that it makes it worth their while making all that additional investment in all that carbon capture and storage technology. And I think that's pretty self-evident. So the idea that technology is an alternative to policy makes no sense.
Okay, so there's a very strong role for governments here. But if we're looking more globally, and we've just heard in the last week from the IPCC that we may have 10 years to address climate change, will the international community be able to act together on this timescale?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is around the international, global dimensions of this problem. We've already seen the agony that's gone into 15 years of trying to construct a global regime during the 90s, having the US pull out at the beginning of this decade, and now several negotiating tracks without it being at all clear really how will this be cracked as an international coordination problem. You have the biggest division still staring us in the face between the industrialized countries, or at least some of them, saying there's very little point in us reducing emissions if developing countries are galloping ahead, versus developing countries saying you must be ridiculous. It's outrageous to suggest that they should be constrained when countries that are emitting five times as much per person are still saying they won't cap their emissions and bring them down. So international coordination is very difficult. I don't think we are going to see a global treaty that covers and caps everything within the next few years. I think that the best hope is that one does get a slightly expanded group of countries led by the major industrialized world that is big enough to really be engineering their economies towards being low carbon economies, are developing the businesses that would flow from that, that those businesses are going global, and you have linkage through things like the Clean Development Mechanism that would help diffuse those low carbon technologies throughout the rest of the world. Is that possible? Yes, I think it is, but it's not easy.
Okay, well, that's an optimistic note to end on, hopefully. So, Professor Grubb, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Michael Grubb of Cambridge University is the chief economist of the UK's Carbon Trust. He was interviewed by Science International's Joanne Baker. Beyond the broad themes of priorities, budgets, and policy, it will be the work of individual scientists that will lead to technical advances toward a sustainable energy future. In this week's special issue, the Science News team profiles a variety of researchers that are working on different pieces of that puzzle. One of those scientists is Dr. Daniel Nocera of MIT, whose group is exploring the possibility of workable photocatalysis, one of the key technologies required to make clean hydrogen-fueled vehicles a reality. We're pleased to have Dr. Nocera on the line to chat with us about his group's work. Dr. Nocera, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Dr. Nocera, hydrogen power and, you know, things like fuel cell vehicles always seem to come up in discussions of new clean energy technologies, but I gather that right now there are still some pretty major hurdles to overcome. What are some of those?
Well, just beginning with the fuel cell side of the problem, which is burning the fuel, burning the hydrogen and oxygen, fuel cells do that over a catalyst called platinum, platinum metal. So what happens is on one side of the fuel cell, you take hydrogen to protons. On the other side of the fuel cell, you take oxygen down to water. Two major hurdles there. First off, the platinum isn't very good at taking oxygen to water. The platinum works well for the process of taking hydrogen to protons, but it's not very good for taking oxygen to water, and the fuel cell loses a lot of power or efficiency in that reaction cell. That's number one. Number two is this use of platinum as a catalyst. If you're going to power a society with fuel cell-based technologies, there's probably not enough platinum in the world to actually make enough fuel cells to run in a large-scale economy. So at the end of the day, we would like to replace platinum with catalysts that are non-noble metal or plentiful. But that's only the tip of the iceberg with fuel cells. A fuel cell uses fuel, and the fuel is hydrogen and oxygen. And where we're going to get the fuel from now, the hydrogen specifically, is from methane. Methane, or natural gas, is a carbon-based fossil fuel. And so, therefore, you're not eliminating that much of the problem in terms of using fuel cells. They're not a magic bullet. If you're getting your hydrogen from methane, you're still producing lots of CO2 if you use fuel cells, because the hydrogen that you're using in the fuel cell came from methane.
And your team wants to replace methane as the hydrogen source with something a lot more plentiful and potentially cleaner, water. As I understand it, the process that you envision for doing this is something like running a fuel cell in reverse. Could you explain what that means?
Fuel cells take hydrogen and oxygen and they release energy. You're taking high energy bonds of hydrogen and oxygen and you're rearranging them in the fuel cell to make water and you release energy. Now, if you're releasing energy, that's favorable. So if fuel cells run what's called a downhill reaction, that's a reaction that will go spontaneously as long as you have a catalyst there, like platinum. The problem is getting back up the hill, the energy hill, effectively, and taking water and rearranging those bonds now to make hydrogen and oxygen. You need an energy input to do that. And so the sort of silver bullet or nirvana of energy would be to use sunlight to rearrange the bonds of water and make the high energy bonds of hydrogen and oxygen. Now, as you know, if you just see sunlight shining on water, you don't see that spontaneously splitting. So what you need to do is you need to make an intermediary, something that can capture the sunlight and then act on the water. So after this sunlight is captured, it's stored either in a molecule or in a solid-state material. That's what photovoltaics effectively do. They capture sunlight, and then they separate the charge. And then what you would like to do is put at that photovoltaic an intermediary or another catalyst that can then take that energy that's been converted from sunlight, say, to electricity in a photovoltaic, and then act on that water and rearrange the bonds, the high energy bonds of hydrogen and oxygen. So that sometimes is called a photocatalyst. A photocatalyst is a catalyst that needs light to do its catalysis as an energy input.
Well, you've stated the basic concept very eloquently and simply, but I guess, as with anything, the devil is in the details. When we were chatting a few minutes ago off the air, you noted that there's just a huge amount of basic science that needs to be done before we can really even understand this process of splitting water to make hydrogen fuel. How long is that all going to take? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. So you're exactly right. I think now everybody is agreeing that we're changing our environment with the use of fossil fuels, i.e. putting CO2 into the atmosphere. If we want to change that connection of energy to fossil fuels snip that connection, and one way is to do water splitting. If the people have that will, I think that they could fund science at a level that within 10 years it could deliver all the technology you would need for water splitting. But that's at a very, very concerted effort in the community. And when I say community, it's a global community of scientists. We don't have that yet. We aren't funding science at the level to make that change occur probably in a timely way, this 10-year cycle. If people really get committed to it in the public and were to say this is a major issue for us in our globe, I'm pretty sure science could deliver it within 10 years. I want to take one step back and say that if everything I just talked to you about, I was successful today and I could deliver a catalyst to you and we could run a fuel cell backwards using sunlight and make all the hydrogen and oxygen that you would need to power our society, I'm still guessing. If you think about infrastructure and just basically changing our society over from an oil-based society to one that involves hydrogen and oxygen, it would take 20 years to implement.
So even with this kind of concerted effort by society, we're still looking at a process that's likely to play out over 3 decades or more. With that in mind, and perhaps on a more personal note, I'm curious about how you find it working in this field at this time. I mean, even though, as you've stated, this really is a long-term undertaking, I imagine that with all the news lately on the climate change front in particular, you must, in some sense, kind of hear the clock ticking.
Yes, I do hear the clock ticking. So I started working on this 20 years ago, undeterred, even when there wasn't funding for it. It was just sort of my life calling, was to respond to this challenge. I find a lot of satisfaction now, and actually comfort, that the world has come around. And it's not just the science world. It's the community, global community at large. Everybody who is rational is now acknowledging that we are changing our environment. That could lead to dire consequences. I think there is the commitment of the public to finally say we need to start changing this. It's something that we can get up every day. I mean, everybody can contribute by driving less, using energy more efficiently. But for scientists in the field, you really feel like you're on the front line. It's a war right now. The war is to get us off this energy dependency of oil as quickly as possible. And you feel a little bit more empowered being on the front line, trying to develop the science that will allow us to do that.
Dr. Nocera, thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me, Stuart.
Daniel Nocera is one of several scientists whose work on sustainable energy technologies is profiled in this week's Science. And that wraps up this special edition Science podcast for February 9th, 2007. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.